This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Snark Monkey number 33 with David Isaacs. Now, David is a really great conversation here. A very thoughtful one. He's a smart guy. I'm finding that as I talk to everybody, I have yet to talk to anybody who's dumber than me. And that may never happen. It doesn't look good. That's okay. No, I'm okay. But here's the thing. If you go back into the history of the Snark Monkey podcast, going way back to like not even a year ago, one of the first podcasts conversations I put up was with Ken Levine. Ken and David were partners together. Their names appeared on more episodes of top-notch, high-quality television than any other writing team that I can think of. And that includes episodes of MASH, episodes of Cheers, and many other shows. They were very much involved in and had a lot to do with creating a golden age of television sitcoms in the 70s and into the 80s. And we talk about that. I get to geek out and reminisce about two of the shows that I loved more than any other as I was growing up. We also get to hear the path of David as compared to the path that we had from Ken Levine and how the two of them from completely different parts of the country found a way to make a magical partnership for as long as it lasted, make each other laugh, find a compatibility, and find a creative relationship that, like I said, is unparalleled, I think. Also, what's very cool about David is that these days he's a big part of the comedy initiative at USC's School of Cinematic Arts. Can you teach comedy to somebody? Well, maybe you can try. We dig into that a little bit, get in depth. It's a very cool conversation. I think you might even learn something. Oh, boy, I shouldn't put that in the intro. It's just people tuning out in droves. Yeah, like anybody's listening to this part. Hey, quit forwarding past this to get to the... Stop it! I have feelings. All right. A great conversation with a very cool guy. This is David Isaacs, Snark Monkey number 33. Enjoy. Thank you for doing this.
My pleasure.
I was actually excited and surprised to discover this is going on, I guess, a little over, not quite 2 years, I guess, when I was at USC for a screening of my buddy Pete Siegel's film Grudge Match,
right,
in which I make a triumphant appearance. and I did the Q&A, and you guys were very complimentary, but I began to see that there was something new over at USC that you are a part of that was both exciting and frustrating to me because, man, if I had had that around.
We all feel that way.
When I was going there.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that, and we'll kind of circle back to your whole life story.
Sure. Well,
in the four hours we have together.
As a professor of screen and television writing, which is my title at the USC School of Cinematic Arts, I've been teaching what my basic expertise was, which was half-hour comedy, TV sitcoms, and taught a lot of other courses because it's about the writing, but specifically that's my bag.
How long have you been doing that?
I've been there about 7 years.
Okay.
Or 8 years coming up.
But there hasn't been a specific, I mean, the cinematic arts generally covered specifically that, just film, basically, and branched into digital arts because of that's obviously a huge field.
Well, there's six separate divisions,
all
of which are encompass all the new media and the whole idea of this broad screen entertainment. But basically what happened was while I was there, my boss, the head of the writing division in the school, is Jack Epps Jr., who is a writer of many contemporary popular films, including Top Gun, Secret of My Success, and Dick Tracy. And he was presented an idea by Barnett Kelman, who is a professor of directing in the school of cinema in the production division, about the idea of creating a comedy initiative, a sort of cross-divisional subject matter that deals with comedy and all its different interpretations and across all the different medium. That sounded like a great idea because, as you said, I'm another person who would have loved to have sort of worked my comic voice, if you will, in college. And obviously in the ancient times when I went, there was no such thing.
Well, I mean, I don't think there was anything that was even that television-oriented when I was there, not from the standpoint of the sitcom,
Agreed.
The half hour.
Agreed. And television is as it slowly begins to sort of rival, if not surpass, film right now. That was a part of it as well. And sitcoms being a sort of, you know, this sort of tentpole of television programming, of television broadcast programming. But long story short, it was Barnett's idea to create a comedy academy so that any student who wanted to work specifically in comedy could take a broad range of courses in writing, half hours, directing half hour, directing comedy in general, sketch comedy, all the different, pretty much all the different forms. And it seemed like a no-brainer to us because we're here in Los Angeles, which is a center of the arts, and so many SC alumni are out there making comic content, Judd Apatow and Paul Feig, Jay Roach, Peter Siegel, you mentioned, are all our alumni and all associated with the school. And we thought we could draw upon their expertise and their support to kind of go forward with this thing and create an actual path, an academic path. We can't call it a major. We can't call it a track for different university reasons. But we could create this initiative and then just work out from there. And so in the last 4 or 5 years, we've added a lot of curriculum, a lot of extra stuff. We have a comedy club that draws from people across campus. It's not just people in cinema. It's people in theater, even business, who want to come over and work out, do improv. We have all kinds of events, and it's all low-hanging fruit. It was all kind of there. It was just a matter of somebody having the idea to put it together, which was Barnett, and then being able to pull Jack and myself in with our own expertise and create a team to sort of run this thing.
That's great. Comedy's really good business right now from the standpoint of everything from shows that are successful in the traditional broadcast manner and more and more comedies that are showing up in lots of different forms on everything from Cartoon Network, Adult Swim, the short form version, or the idea of even a Funny or Die video, the quality of those, the production value of those, the amount of attention those get. Mm-hmm. There are people, I think of the ladies Broad City, who started something on YouTube, basically, and turned it into a series. Now,
well, there's room for niche comedy. And in fact, I think that's where the state of the art is right now, because I don't think sitcoms are in a particularly, we're not in a sort of classic golden age of sitcom right now. When I talk about traditional sitcom.
Yeah.
No one's going to remember this as a golden age of sitcom as they did 30 years ago when comedies dominated. Right now, we're in a sort of golden age of drama, I think.
That's true. But but comedy has found maybe just a different venue to become popular.
Oh, most definitely.
And I certainly think that the way comedy's changed, certainly the half-hour sitcom that you're talking about, the multi-camera live audience type of sitcom, is barely around. Mm-hmm. I mean, huge hits like Big Bang Theory and Two and a Half Men, which has moved on, and a couple of exceptions mm-hmm. still exist. But for my money, because I grew up loving, Cheers, one of my favorite mm-hmm. shows of all time,
yeah.
period.
Well,
I mean, there are the...
Yeah.
I feel like the last couple of years has seen a different style, a different point of view. Tina Fey and 30 Rock, Parks and Rec, that group, the Community series that the most recent season that's mm-hmm. on Yahoo Screen, which from a creative standpoint almost entirely overcompensates for the fact that Yahoo Screen is a terrible place to watch a show right now.
Well, that'll emerge.
And I'll yell at them later in a different podcast. But there's really quality material going on in so many different places.
Listen, most of my favorite stuff is not on, we're just talking comedy, most of my favorite stuff is not on the broadcast network.
Yeah, I think we can all say that right now. Huh?
It's on, I'll plug them all. It's on, Portlandia, which is IFC, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Yeah, I was going to mention that on Netflix.
Those are the things that
Silicon Valley and Veep right now,
and Veep may be the best sort of mainstream, if you will, comedy right now, or at least a comedy that will be nominated for an Emmy, if that's any indicator. And Silicon Valley as well. And those are on HBO. Some people would say Shameless. I don't necessarily see it as a comedy, but that's me. That stuff is better. And you see Funny or Die or College Humor, things like Children's Hospital, on
right.
Adult Swim. I mean, they're all kind of I put them in those shows that I just mentioned, and I love them, and I loved 30 Rock, and I loved The Office. But they are more what I would, and I'm an old timer, so I have a perspective that way. But I call those kind of absurdist comedies, and they have a sort of narrower audience, even though I think they're as good or better than almost anything that has a sort of mass audience, and it's mass audience because it's on a broadcast network. You're right about multicam. It's just not, there's a sameness to it that revolves around basically no content. It's about I'd even put Big Bang Theory off to the side because I think the joke writing in that is spectacular and at least it is about something else. All the other shows that are on CBS, the multicam shows, some of the other stuff on NBC, it's really the same thing.
Yeah,
it's more premise-y than it is character. And when it's character, it's all about who's gonna bang who. So, and who's not gonna bang who, and that gets tiresome. You know, even though there's some very good comedy writers doing it.
I think the interesting thing about the fact that we brought up, Netflix and HBO and those places that are supplying some of the better comedies right now, it's not even what it wouldn't necessarily be about language and content there, even though that exists on those shows. They just happen to be really funny. They're written
truly
sharper and better. It's because if you remember, I've had a couple of people in here talking about this sort of thing, Jeff Greenstein and Bob Cushell, who both mm-hmm. got their start on Dream On. And Dream On, while not a show that necessarily reached any sort of critical mass and popularity, became notorious purely because of the content,
right,
because you could show boobies and you had those.
But
little...
even then it wasn't that kind of snarky talk about sex.
Right, right.
It wasn't.
Integrated into this guy's life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's almost kind of I can't do it because John Stewart does the, I won't be able to do it on radio, but, or podcast, but it's kind of like that look that Jon Stewart makes when he's made a mistake, like he's embarrassed or something.
Right,
you know,
right.
If you watch The Daily Show, you know what I'm talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of a little boy's snarky little joke he made. And that's what it feels like.
Yeah.
It feels as if there's the storytelling, you don't care. And it's my theory that someone will come along, and I could be wrong, someone will come along and write about something in that multicam style, because I think that proscenium kind of style in front of an audience is still has great value and validity in terms of comedy, but no one is writing about anything that is of any great consequence or is feels different right now.
I think the thing for me, I remember sitting down with my screenwriting professor at USC, Mark Harris.
Yeah.
And we, it was
a very great professor.
I thought he was awesome. Mm-hmm. And he did teach me a lot. Not that I used it for anything, but I thought it was interesting. I've never forgotten this because here I was at USC, and it was very cinematic oriented, and it was my track was supposed to be directing, and I was very interested in writing, and we talked probably for an hour about the Cheers pilot that mm-hmm. we had both watched separately, and mm-hmm. I remember that to this day because there was something different going on in that mm-hmm. show.
Yeah.
And it was more than just the look of it, which was definitely different. It was more than the fact that it was this kind of amazing set. And mm-hmm. I've had your partner in crime, Ken Levine, on. And we've talked about this a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But the characters that were created and the relationships that were created on that show, it was the combination of all of these things. But there was something about that that was, for lack of a better term, cinematic to me.
Yeah.
And that's where my professor, Mr. Harris, and I think we sat there and gushed. And we had seen one episode.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so special. It established these people and this place.
Right.
There is a premise there, but it was really not. It wasn't the Sam Diane thing necessarily that moved me, that hooked me. It was everything else about it.
Well, it was. We'd be getting into some heavy discussion here about comedy and
you got some Freud you want to throw in?
No,
you
it's
some,
not Freud so no? much as the sort of...
So you're a Jungian, is what
you're
saying.
Yeah, well, it's exactly what I'm going to say. It's archetypical, you know?
Yeah.
It's relatable. It's identifiable. You know somebody like that. Or that person is a very specific type of archetype.
Not to be flip, but it really was about being in a place where everybody knows
you.
No,
it's family.
It's totally
it's family.
What it was.
It's family. It's a place you go... because you want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
It's an escape.
Yep.
And then you're there and you can laugh with and at the people that are participating. You need an inner conflict, which is the Sam and Diane thing. You need something that sort of drives the narrative because it can't be just nut of the week walking through the door, you know, the angry Yankee fan or the or the nerd who goes to Harvard, both of which we did. But that, of course, drove that initial romance, that sexual tension, which hadn't been really done before, strangely enough. That another reason it was fresh really drove the series. But you enjoyed the spirit of the place. And also in any good, my particular, it's not my theory, it's what we all used to say, that any particularly good sitcom in the forefront, or not in the forefront, but there's a kind of theme that runs through it, in the background that runs through everything that we can all identify, which is promises unfulfilled. I'm not getting what I want.
Right, right.
But there's these people here that support me. All of that is kind of lying underneath it, you know, kind of in the background.
I think,
and it makes you feel, I think, like you want to come back.
I think that's
one really of the unglib way.
No, it's because I think that's the kind of magical thing about Cheers in particular, even down to the theme song. I can't quite place, I've talked with other people about this, I can't quite place what it is about that theme song, because it is not this happy, peppy little song. Mm-hmm. It has this air of melancholy to it,
yeah,
with these, you know, old-timey images of, you know, right, bars from years past where people are drinking and carousing or whatever. But just the tone of the song, the key of the, yeah, song is...
Yeah.
Is,
well, you hit it. It,
yeah,
is the sort of key of the song,
and it's not sad,
no,
but I think it is what you just described.
It's simply that, and that's the genius of it, you know. And you never kind of plan these things. These things have to come to you, you know. The guys,
right,
who created the show, Glenn and Les Charles and Jim Burrows, are all incredible craftsmen and in particular areas. And smart and literate and wise beyond most writers that I had worked with, including myself, but still there were happy accidents. And,
yeah,
so somebody, goes out and writes that tune. Gary and Judy, who wrote the tune, I mean, you couldn't find that. It's like two pieces of a puzzle that you just come upon.
Yeah.
It fits right, exactly right. But that says that what you're doing, the canvas you've created is a perfectly simple idea that will take pieces that will fit it.
Yeah.
Perfectly.
It's pretty remarkable. Since I've talked to Ken, I feel like I've talked a lot about your history as well as his, but you guys had...
It's pretty much the same.
Yeah. Although we'll get to yours specifically,
yeah,
because I'm curious about that. Your background has a lot to do with who you are and
mm-hmm,
how you got to where you got.
Mm-hmm.
And also because the two of you ended up working on more than a couple of the most... lauded and, I would dare say, iconic shows in the
mm-hmm
history of those of sitcoms, and they're not the same. I mean, even Cheers and Frasier, not the same.
No, different.
And the fact that MASH was really the first major job that both of you guys had in terms of anything long term,
mm-hmm,
was not by any means a traditional sitcom from the way it was produced.
Least traditional, certainly of its time, and maybe still to this day.
Yeah. So tell me about, first of all, where were you born? Where did you grow up?
I was born in New York,
okay,
and lived there as a youngster, and then moved down to Florida with my folks. Moved there from, you know, it's a kind of a natural migration down to southern Florida.
That's not a stereotype. That,
no, it's
that
not.
Actually exists.
It's not.
How old were you when you moved to Florida?
Oh, I was about, I was in my early adolescent period.
Was that traumatic? Or?
Yes, because I had already kind of grown to be a part of what I grew up in, and so my.
You were a New York.
New York is different from Miami, although,
sure,
the culture is kind of the same, or was the same at the time. In some ways, it's like we always just say a piece of New York broke off and, you know, landed down there. and then there's a whole other culture, the major culture that is part of that city now, but. I was kind of in a strange place with that and never really took to it, although you adapt as a kid. I went to the University of Miami. I wasn't much of a student, and I went to the University of Miami because they would take me. And at that
I believe
time,
that's still the criteria,
well,
right?
No, actually, Miami has become quite a – no, I mean, it was at the time. It was a – it was noted as a place you could get into,
mm-hmm,
and not so much anymore. It's a very much more lauded school now. And I think it's in the top 50 of the U.S. News and World Report rankings. But that aside, I went there and I kind of didn't know what I wanted to do. And I just had an affinity, I think, always for comedy. Comedy was kind of like what I loved to listen to.
Did that come from your folks? What did your parents do?
Well, I came from a typical Jewish, you know, an absurd kind of world, which I won't go into too much. I had a very loving mom and dad, but we...
But you had characters, right?
You have characters.
You had a built-in sitcom,
yeah,
I would guess.
And I had that kind of underdog feeling about myself, you know, and I thought the one thing I could do was sort of make people laugh.
When did you discover that?
I think at an early age. I feel that kind of forms in you around 4, 5, 6 years old.
When were you grabbing jokes from the radio or something?
No,
or
no,
you
I
were
just kind of, you had, I was always so it had a natural sort of a class clown.
Okay.
All my report cards came back as no self-control and that kind of stuff.
That
I guess the early background of everybody who goes into comedy at some point or in some way.
Yeah. You would have been perhaps diagnosed with ADD or ADHD at that point.
I think I was pretty normal.
No, I'm pretty convinced that almost anybody who ended up in comedy or stand-up or anything like that would, in this day and age, have some sort of scientific diagnosis.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there were two things that I think helped me a lot. One in terms of the writing, is I read a lot as a kid.
Yeah.
And the other thing was I just had that. I subconsciously or around the surface somewhere, I understood that I saw things differently. I just knew that I did. And I knew I could get a reaction from that. And so that's comedy.
Was it a self-defense thing, too? Was it getting out of trouble with bullies?
On the playground,
yeah.
Places like that. If you could make people laugh, it saved your life in a lot of cases. It sounds very typical. When I got to college, I really wasn't interested in anything particularly. I took a communications course, which had a kind of smattering of everything that modern cinema schools have, you know, a little bit of production, a little bit of writing, a little bit, you know, but nothing
but,
that.
But you were leaning toward something entertainment-ish.
Yeah, somehow I thought that's got to be what it is. I knew I wasn't going to be a businessman. I knew.
Was it as a performer, perhaps? Were you thinking?
I wasn't sure,
you
but
didn't
I
gravitate
knew,
to the stage.
I knew it. Well, the stage seemed quite frightening to
me.
It was easy to do in a small crowd or in a car with my friends, but to stand in front of 50 strangers or more seemed, or 10, depending on where I was going to be, seemed very daunting, and I never really tried it.
Did you have comedic heroes?
Who
were they?
Well, used to be my comedic hero, Bill Cosby.
Before I had music, you know, albums, before I had rock and roll, I had
comedy albums.
Yep.
Cosby was one.
Sure.
Smothers Brothers were another. I loved Jonathan Winters. My parents would let me watch him on the Jack Parr show, not the Tonight Show, but the Jack Parr show.
All right. And Jack would just like give him a stick.
And he would just improvise.
Yeah.
And it was wild
insane.
And crazy. And he was unlike anybody else. And then guys like Robert Klein, who I thought sounded like the guys you hung out with.
Yeah.
And that was kind of like, I was attracted to Klein because Klein was kind of like what you did, the way you talked on the corner. And
so the funny guy in the corner with some attitude.
Yeah, observations and stuff like that. Woody Allen, if I haven't mentioned it. And,
Klein gets mentioned so much by comedians who came up at a certain time, but I don't know that he gets the kind of credit maybe that
I don't think he does, and I know Seinfeld was a big fan of his,
right?
And other people, I'm sure, from that ilk. Klein was very hip guy, and so was David Steinberg, and now that I'm sort of recalling names, And of course, we had all those albums and the 2,000-Year-Old Man and all those kind of things. And what changed me and what I knew, something I knew, it was like it changed the way I looked at what I was going to do or gave me a kind of passion for it, I suppose, was I was about 19 and I was in school and I went to a art theater, which they don't have anymore, you know, the theater in town that played, you know, Breathless and Never on Sunday and those kind of movies. And they were playing Woody Allen's first, you know, sort of independent feature, Take the Money and Run.
Yes.
And when I saw that, it really did a number on me. I remember sitting there and thinking, I've never seen anything quite like this. This is so funny on a totally different level
than
any mainstream comedy, anything that I've seen that were, you know, the standard kind of what were comedies in the 60s, the Jack Lemmon, you know,
right.
Films.
The grown-up comedies at that point. Because they had started to edge into more kind of adult content.
Exactly.
No, this was a documentary, certainly one of the first parodies of a documentary.
And I wasn't that tuned into stuff that I learned later on, like that I really discovered because of that, the Marx Brothers and Keaton and even some of the early Bob Hope stuff. So seeing this, I had no idea what the roots were to this. And if you see the Marx Brothers and if you see Bob Hope, you know that Woody Allen was influenced by them. But I didn't know that. I just saw somebody, to me, working in a completely original way.
Right. It was this very sophisticated filmmaking.
Totally sophisticated.
But gags.
Incredibly silly.
Yes.
Gags.
Joke after joke.
Yeah, there's one that I'll never forget that I nearly fell out of my seat, which was he played cello in the marching band. And so he had to play and sitting in his chair and then pick the chair up, run and catch up to them and play again. Now, that's pretty basic kind of silent movie stuff.
Yeah,
if you
totally.
Think about it. But for a kid, it was like nobody was doing anything like that.
For me, I automatically go to carving the gun out of soap.
Yes.
And making it black with shoe polish, and then and then the day of the escape from prison, it's raining.
Right.
So it just turns into a giant fistful of suds.
Or they're taking pictures of the bank. They're taking movies of the 8mm movies of the bank. They're gonna case, and so the gang is gonna play the movies back. But first, you know, they have a short trout fishing in Vermont. It was wild and it was silly,
pushing the form of something that you felt familiar, but it was in a framework that you had never seen before. So you knew you were seeing something brand new.
I was inspired.
Yeah.
If we can sum it up, I was inspired and I thought I gotta ideally do something like that. I didn't know how I was going to do it. I didn't know where I was going to do it. I just knew this is what I like. And that then spurred me to discover all these other very famous comedians and filmmakers. And so I kind of steeped myself in a lot of that stuff. And I even worked in the summers. I worked in Miami Beach in the hotels. And, you know, as a kid, you could go around to the different hotels and sweep their beach and work at the pool a little bit. And then I get a regular job. And I'd hang around at night. And there, you know, a lot of comics would come and be in their nightclubs in those days, you know, no one would even know these names, but guys like Charlie Callis and Corbett Monica, you know, B-level comics who would come.
But they're doing the circuit.
I would watch how, and it was that reaction, that ability to get just enormous amounts of laugh that I just took in. And I think I had an aptitude for it, but I, in my own way, I kind of studied it. So I was ready when I got my big break, which was when I came out here after I had graduated from college and spent a year still back there working, and then just decided I had to come out here.
What was that motivation? You just knew that if you were going to have a chance at anything, it was going to have to be out here. This is where the industry was.
The Miami Beach of 1972 offered me nothing. But basically handing out towels, you know, to the general public.
I mean, you could have written jokes for comics. I mean, did you ever have that kind
of inclination?
No.
I just didn't know how to do that or where to go.
No connections
to it.
But you had no connections here either, did you?
No, I didn't. It's
a bigger leap to go, I'm going to go 3,000 miles to where they make it.
I had a friend who I'd gone to college with who had moved out here. You got married and moved out here. And he would call me and say, get your ass out here. This is like the best. And I said, yeah, I got to do it one time. And I finally just got in the car and drove out and stayed on the couch. His wife and they had a small apartment in Burbank. And I slept on their couch for about 6 months and probably helped break up their marriage. But they were young as well. But it was probably meant to be.
It's not your fault, David. It's not your fault.
And then the rest is just a lot of serendipity. He and I were in a army unit. My friend and I, we had both been in the Army Reserves and we had 6 years to serve. And So when I came out here, he helped me get in the unit he was in, which was a Armed Forces radio unit. And that's where I met Levine. He was in it as well. And we met at the first summer camp that I had to go to in Fort Carson, Colorado. Ken and I became friendly talking about comedy.
Yeah.
And
did you guys make the connection? Because he has mentioned this. The switch that flipped for him involved Woody Allen as well. At
yes.
a different time in his life. But it was the same sort of thing of, oh, my God, this guy is, you know, writing down funny things.
Yeah.
I mean, it hit him in much the same way. In a theater, watching a film, and just a different way of getting that information across.
Well, all of us who do this, I imagine, have some seminal figure that grabbed us in a sense. Boy, that suddenly sounded very very pornographic.
Would you like to rephrase the question?
What's the difference? At this age, who cares? I am what I am.
Nobody's going to misinterpret that.
But anyway, you know, there is always someone who's your hero or someone who speaks to you in a way. I'm sure that's true for any art.
It is. Yeah, there is. I mean, and that's the thing that I find the most interesting is kind of not only who it is, but what's that moment? Because there's almost a moment. I mean, the fact that you sit there and can talk about Take the Money and Run, and it's so indelible in your mind.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, not even the film, but the feeling you had.
Yeah.
And like that overwhelming sensation of kind of, oh, I think I'm on to something.
I think that it was a melding of what I was, who I am,
mm-hmm.
what I knew I could conceivably do, and the fact that someone was doing it
right
in an ideal way to me.
So many people.
That was an epiphany.
I guess I shouldn't be surprised because I felt like I went through the whole thing. I didn't end up getting into film. I got into radio, but
I
think so much of my sensibility was absolutely influenced by Letterman, watching him at a time when I was starting to do that. And I guess I shouldn't be surprised, like I said, by the number of people in comedy who have said he was their guy.
Well,
but it makes sense. It's another one of those.
I'm a little older than you, and I think for your generation, he is that figure because he, to me, is the seminal figure of that kind of stand back, ironic mm-hmm. kind of look at things. You know, I remember the first time I saw Letterman on stage. I saw him at the Comedy Store in the probably mid-70s, and he hit me with this very simple joke, which was, McDonald's has ribs now, and isn't that a dream come true? And I remember thinking, it's a different form.
Yeah.
It's a little different form.
Right.
I'm not that smart, but I remember thinking delivery and the way he's just kind of, he's not forcing anything. He's just telling you what mm-hmm. you already know, and he's... I mean, you saw it last month when he retired. There was a real outpouring of people who I think feel very, however you felt about Dave at the end, certainly at the beginning of his journey, and he was a icon for many people.
Well, that's what I kind of see is, and you've hit it because we've talked about it already here, is that you're seeing something familiar, but somebody's taken, it's not even a huge leap, but it's this alteration of the way it's delivered and the way it's perceived.
Yeah.
But you get it. I mean, you immediately get it. So you and Ken had that connection, and then that started, and he's told me this. It's funny because you came from a communications major, I guess, is mm-hmm. basically what you had.
Mm-hmm.
But there was nothing like, not even remotely like what you're working with now at USC in terms of...
No, oh my God, no.
So, I mean, and so you've been trying to kind of find your path. And he told me you guys just watched, analyzed,
mm-hmm.
you wrote down the beats. You didn't even have a way really of kind of getting these scripts. It's so easy to just Google...
Oh, yeah, no.
You know, I mean, a script these days.
I mean, it was... We were not yet in the information age yet, or the ubiquity of of all of this material.
But you had the sensibility to that there is a structure to it. You made that.
In many ways, I think we helped ourselves in some ways because it helped us concentrate on the not only the sound, but the tempo of dialogue and things like that. Because we couldn't watch it again, we could only tape it, audio tape it. So we would listen back to it as a good radio show. And Jim Burrows used to say a good sitcom, at least we're talking 30 years ago, could be a good television sitcom, could still be a good radio sitcom. You don't, the visuals are not as important as the characters and the dialogue. So, or at least I think that's what he was saying. But we stumbled upon that because we had no other choice.
Right.
There was no way we could watch it again. And we would go to a place called Larry, I think it still exists, a Larry Edmonds bookstore off Hollywood Boulevard and buy scripts, and look at them. And we watched, and this was a lifestyle choice as well because we had no money. Neither one of us had money.
Right.
And so we
apparently
were
not dating either.
No,
if you're
I had a girlfriend.
Oh, okay.
Maybe he had a girl. I don't remember. No, I had a girlfriend. And we would hang out at her place and get some takeout food and watch the Saturday night lineup on CBS, which is All in the Family and MASH, Mary Tyler Moore, Bob Newhart Show, then Carol Burnett. And we would just sit there and watch them. Mary was kind of the touchstone show for us. It was like the characters in the writing were sort of cut above.
Well, Mary
Newhart
Tyler
Moore. Newhart was more, it had its own kind of, Newhart had its own sort of style that was a little bit more bent than Mary.
Yeah.
Or
well, it was so built around his stand-up style
that it was totally his
voice.
It was funny in its own sort of special way. But that was just for what was available to you in terms of what you could access. That was a pretty stunning evening.
Yeah, you couldn't have had a better...
And there was no money to go anywhere or go out to eat or anything like that. And frankly, when All in the Family was on, there were nobody in restaurants anyway. So,
that's
or go
funny.
To the theater. So
yeah, even somebody of the modern era, Dave Finkel, has been in this room and who runs New Girl. And one of my favorite things ever said on this podcast so far is as far as advice. It's like, if you haven't watched every episode of every season of All in the Family and want to be a TV writer, well, then fuck you. And I mean, he touts that personally as the template of characters, interaction, jokes, something moving, something. I mean, the way to integrate all the elements that you need in a great
comedy. That's what I say. It's about something.
Yes.
It's about fear of change, is essentially. I believe in fear as the driver of every fear of whatever, fear of abandonment, fear of shame, fear of change, which is a big fear for a lot of people, and that's what that show's about.
Archie
is afraid of the change that's going on around him. He's losing, and it's played out in a dynamic way because he's losing his daughter to his only child, to a guy that he couldn't be more in a disagreement with, and that's the fountain. That's the source of it, and. That when I say somebody's got to write something like that, it doesn't have to be that because we're in a different era and a different time. But somebody's got to write something about I got caught with this girl in my bedroom by somebody. I mean, it's just somebody's going to get to it.
Right.
You
right.
Know, somebody, I hope, I'm like Moses. I won't be going there with you, but there is a promised land. I won't be crossing over the Jordan, but I want to point you towards
it. Yes. You see the destination.
Yeah. Yes.
It is not your journey to take.
I've compared myself to a major biblical figure.
Well, we're touching all different aspects of your life here. We've gone pornographic and we've gone biblical. So, do you remember how bad the first script was that you guys wrote?
It was typical.
Yeah,
I think there were some jokes in it that might still hold up. I don't know. The subject matter was what we knew, which was college, and there was a sort of absurd madness to the whole thing, and it was about guys who couldn't get laid, and you know, what we wrote about what we knew
write
about,
what you know, yeah.
in our own particular style. I remember it was good enough that it got us an agent who wasn't really enthusiastic about us, but our first person was going to take our stuff around. So it couldn't have been totally bad. And then somebody suggested in those days that it was better to write specs of existing shows
right.
than it was to do original stuff. And so we took that advice and started knocking out specs of the wonderful series that we loved, which was the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And the irony is we started a MASH and just felt it was too difficult and put it down. but our plan was to just keep writing until somebody somehow would get our material and discover us. And it,
well,
it
that's
takes
it,
that
right?
kind of
it's
mindset.
It's work ethic, right?
It
I mean,
is.
It's the – so many people have mentioned Malcolm Gladwell in these podcasts because that's
yeah.
so easy to say. But that's it. I mean, you just have to
– It's the simple message yeah. of our time. The 10,000 hours is the – there's no better way, simpler,
yeah.
better way to put it.
You have to put it the time.
10,000 hours. That doesn't have to be 10,000 hours of writing.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to be 10,000 hours of studying – and comparing and analyzing and contrasting and all of those things that kind of start to put the craft into your head.
The fact that you, both of you, got traction so quickly says something about not just what you had already put in, but the fact that they're, again, a little touched by magic. I mean, do you recognize why you and Ken in particular? Tell me about that working relationship or creative relationship.
I think we both found each other funny. So
you made each other laugh.
We made each other laugh. And he still can make me laugh. No one can make me laugh. There are times that I would go out of my way to find ways to exacerbate his frustration in a room because his sarcasm just goes up. Like, you know, exponentially when he
yes.
gets frustrated. And there's nobody funnier
yeah.
because he's just incredibly – he's at his funniest when he's at his most sarcastic.
Is it as clear-cut as somebody's a joke guy, somebody's a scenario guy, somebody's a character guy, somebody's
no,
like a dialogue
never,
guy?
We never looked at it that
somebody's
way.
Somebody's a messy guy, somebody's
learned,
a clean guy.
We learned story a lot together.
Yeah.
I think Ken was ahead of me in a sense because he had worked in radio and his mind worked faster. And I was a little more deliberate, but maybe that worked out well for us when we were writing. I don't know. But we just always respected the other guy's take, which I think is the reason to work with somebody, because if that person doesn't laugh at something you've pitched, and you trust their sense of humor and trust their judgment, then there's something wrong, and you begin to work on why doesn't it work.
You were able to get to that place pretty quickly.
Yeah, we went
you
pretty quickly
too
that
protective
way. We always
of your...
went to the third option.
Yeah.
Like if we both pitched and neither one liked the other one, we would always agree, let's try something else. And that's not to say we didn't have some arguments. That's not to say we didn't have some pretty yelling matches in our time. But it was never actually about the work itself. There was never any my way or the highway. And if anything... we would do things like, I'll give you this one, you know.
Did you keep your own
yeah, and we
running
had the joke,
tally?
The joke, like, well, you just ruined the whole thing. That was just, so you just kind of play the absurdity of it,
yeah.
and that sort of takes the tension out of it.
Yeah,
it's like a marriage. It's just like a marriage. If you don't respect the other person's space, if you don't respect the other person's opinion, if it's my way or the highway, you got troubles.
I suspect, much like many of these kind of collaborations, you spent more time together than spouses. I mean,
we spent every day together for the better part of every working day together, every weekday for the most part. Even the weekends we wrote, we would have to write, but we try to reserve that time for ourselves or family and stuff. But as far as weekdays go, every day for the better part of over 20 years, 25 years. Then Ken decided to direct, and I was doing some consulting of shows when we were under contract at Paramount. And so we didn't spend that every day together. But we did spend more time with each other than we did our families or our spouses or anything like that. In fact, it was a great story. When my wife and I were getting married back in 89, we went to a jewelry broker in Beverly Hills. She called me and said, and she worked near Beverly Hills, and she said, could you meet me in Beverly Hills at the jewelry broker? Because I picked out the, you know, I picked out the ring, and he's got it for me, and we need to pay for it. And so I said to Kenny, you know, let's, I got to go to, we were at Paramount. I said, in Hollywood, so we had to go over to Beverly Hills. I said, come on with me. We can eat there. I got to meet Leslie and pay for this ring. And he said, okay, cool. So he comes with me to the broker, and she's there. And I could tell right away she's pissed, you know. But I don't know why. It could be just work or something like that. I'm not putting two and two together yet. I'm going to pay for the thing. And then I say, you know, we're going to go to lunch. And she had to go back to work. And later on, I talked to her. I was like, well, you seem mad at me today. She goes, you bring your partner for buying my ring? And you bring your partner to it? And I said, well, I don't understand. We're just buying the ring. I'm not putting it on your finger. And this is the kind of romantic human being I am. And it's the kind of, you know, the kind of Casanova, Scaramouche.
You Lothario, yes.
Yes.
Smooth talker.
You know, sweep them off their feet. And I said, no, we do this every day. We go to lunch. I didn't think of that. I said, we had to go to, I was coming at my lunch hour. We had to go to lunch. And she was like, you're just useless. And that's the kind of time, I mean, our lives were just, we were the guys. We just did stuff every day. We ate. We take a break. We go to lunch. We never talk about the script unless we had an idea for it. And it was sports and movies and women. And that was it. That was what we do.
When you did.
I mean, I don't. We weren't. When I say women, we weren't having like nooners or anything. We were talking about women.
Sure did. Okay. So when you did get to the point where the partnership became not a partnership, you were both pursuing kind of singular things.
Yeah, Ken more than me, I think, because he always had radio. Then he had baseball. You know, he's a play-by-play announcer. I mean,
he's done a ridiculous.
I call him the entertainment machine.
Yeah,
he just has a ridiculous.
He's a little too good at too many things, and that pisses me off.
He's a Renaissance man of sort of you know, popular culture, I guess.
Yeah.
He's a good. People don't know about it. He's a great caricaturist. He's just very multi-talented.
Were you okay, kind of being on your own at that?
Yeah,
point?
I always was. Yeah. I mean, also, once again, you respect the other person's space.
Sure.
If this is what you want to do, man, go do it. You know, I'm okay. I mean, there were times when we had to talk it over in terms of how our deal was at the studio. But other than that, it was, you know, if you wanted to do baseball, I'll be on the show and I'll send you an outline. You write it. I'll rewrite it. We'll turn it in. You know, we could do it. We could work together that way. And then just came a point where he wanted to direct more. But we always could write together. It wasn't like, okay, we're done.
Mm-hmm.
There was never that day. What I got into teaching was really the biggest moment where I said, you know, the pursuit of this is over for me. Frasier had ended, our 20-year contract at Paramount was over, business was changing, we were still going in and selling pilots and making deals, but we came up to the networks with a particular idea that I thought we were really prepared for. We had the two leads already. We had a great idea. I had never come to a network pitch meeting in better shape, I thought. And no one bought it. And that's with the two leads in the room, doing a scene from it, everything. I mean, it's just like, this is the show, guys. You don't even have to kind of guess what it's going to be. No one bought it. And I remember being in the parking lot at CBS and just saying to Ken, you know, I think I'm done. I think I'm done.
Wow.
chasing the dream, because if they didn't buy this, they're not buying anything. It's us, or it's the kind of ideas we're coming in with. I don't know what it is, but this seems patently impractical now, you know? And he said, you know, I was thinking the same thing.
Really?
And at that moment, I thought, I got to look at other things to do. I've got to think about it. I mean, I didn't say, well, I'll never do this again. It was just the day-to-day, calling the agent, this meeting here, that meeting there, that I wanted to, that to end. And
well,
so did he.
That's a pretty self-aware thing to say. I mean,
that's got me into teaching.
Yeah. You certainly had enough success at that point.
Oh, yeah.
That it was probably, I mean, but there are people in your line of work who just continue to want to try and accomplish that again and then just reach. It's like the athlete playing well beyond his peak, thinking, I can get that championship.
I felt like I didn't want to be that guy sitting in Nate Nowell's going, you know, business stinks and no one's doing great stuff anymore. I didn't want to be that guy. And you're right. I mean, we had incredible success and luck, opportunities that very few people get a chance to do. And we were able to see them through. And frankly, it seemed like, you know, I've had my share. It's like, you know, you don't want to, I don't wish this, but you know, you don't want to be at Warren Beatty's deathbed, and the last thing he says is, "I wish I had met more women." You know, it's just, you got to know when you had yours, and I think that was that moment, and life has been very nice beyond that.
Part of the reason I get a little resentful of that, of the fact that I missed some of this opportunity at USC, is because I had the other, a lot of my instructors, I had great instructors. I had guys like Mark Harris and people like that. Mm-hmm. I had the other side of the instructors, which was the guys who had, you know, directed a couple of episodes of Gunsmoke and were bitter about the fact that they didn't become something else.
There's always that.
So now in your current role as an instructor, as an imparter of wisdom, as somebody who is guiding young talents in the field that you have learned so well, what are you seeing on their end? Is it kind of the same thing you've been used to seeing as you were coming up as far as the approach?
Look, not everybody, look, honestly, you know, not everybody's going to make it, you know, and you do see, in the course of a year or a couple of years, you see a couple of people, they're slam dunk going to make it. If they have the mindset that when they get out there, they're tough about staying with it and networking and doing all the things that they have to do, it's a slam dunk. This person will be. And I'm usually right. I mean, in the time that I've been there, 7-8 years, I've had 4 or 5 of those people and that I've specifically said, got it, you know, and those people do. They, you know, the cream rises. And then there are people who are, if they work hard at it and they keep at the craft, they should make it. And there's some people that, and I could be wrong, there are some people that just, they're not in the right niche, or they think they should be this or they think they should be that. My job is not to mess with anybody's dream. They're all there because they love entertainment. And they want to provide it, and they want to be a part of it, and for whatever reason they start doing it, they're in it, and my job is to make. I look at it as my job is to inform them as best I can what to expect, how to do it better, and in the particular case of the USC School of Cinema's writing division, it's all based on character. It's all about character. A good story is great characters. Character causes the conflict. Conflict causes the story. You know, not to get too scientific, but the more you can pull from your own point of view and your own sense of who you are and what you have to say, the better you're going to be.
As much as the business has changed, as much as the methodology to get there has changed, the basic template is still...
It's still the same.
Exactly.
You're still telling a story.
Yep.
And that's what most young people coming out lack. They know a word called plot, and they don't know how to navigate plot. Mm-hmm. And my feeling is, don't even use the word, you know? Give me some characters in a situation. and let's work from that.
And they'll kind of tell you where to go.
And they'll tell you where to go, and you'll and their change the change of that character, even if it's in a movie, if it's from point A to point Z, and in a television pilot, if it's point A to point A1, you know, there's a theme, there's an arc, that arc, and then the obstacles that that character faces are where the story comes, as opposed to I need a scene here or something should happen here. I mean, not to diminish anybody's, any of the many books that are written about how to write a screenplay, and there are some very good ones in terms of orienting you to the form. But if you're writing it in accordance to a graph, you know, when rising action should come on page 35, you're just writing a graph. You're copying a graph with dialogue, and that's why I not to sell SC, but it, and I'm sure other schools have it. It's about how to engage an audience with relatable, identifiable emotions, and those are the always end up being the best kinds of stories, and the kinds of stories we respond to, and the kind of stories that can change your life, like a very simple, you know, take the money and run, in my case.
Right.
Oh, look, I had a conclusion.
Let me, can we get purely nostalgic to wrap things up here?
Sure.
And this is putting you on the spot a little bit, but because I have such an affection for it, just give me a great Cheers story. Just whatever comes to mind.
I'd have to, one I can't tell you.
What? No, that's the one I want to hear.
Well, I'll tell you a little inside thing about your favorite. I'm not going to single out any particular characters, but you know, towards the end of the series, when the actors had for the most part played those characters over 200 times or more, they get a little bit like bored with it, and a little the idea is it's sort of a challenge is to learn it as late in the week as you can, as they say, we'll learn it on the steps. So if you walk behind the bar at Cheers, this is the case all through the series, but really towards the end, if you walk behind the bar at Cheers, there were little parts of the script taped to the bar so that they could look at them, and essentially little cue cards all over the place. You went to the back of that bar, it was all dialogues just taped to the, you know.
And just they accumulated, paint, layers of paint
down,
over the years.
But it was your favorite actors are, you know, they get a little bored with what they're doing. They have to find a different way to do it.
Is there a joke that you remember writing, your particular line you're particularly proud of?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of good ones. My favorite episode, actually, that Ken and I wrote, since it's my hour here, was an episode where it was Frasier's bachelor party, and I just always loved this. Frasier walked in to the bar, and the guys were going to throw him a bachelor party, and he said, he walks in, and he says, "Gentlemen," I'm paraphrasing, "gentlemen, I heard a song on the radio tonight that I think speaks to the kind of revelry that we all want to participate in. Everybody have fun tonight. Everybody Wang Chung tonight." And I still see that and laugh. And then the thing I'm most proud of is we did an episode where Frasier's son, Frederick, was not speaking yet at about, you know, a year old. And Lilith and he were both concerned, and Lilith was blaming it on the lack of stimulation with him bringing Frederick to Cheers. And the joke was that at the end, the baby's first words would be "Norm." But we had to build that.
Right.
So we had to write, I think, 5 or 6 Norm entrances, which were the most difficult because it's pure joke writing.
Right.
It's set up joke.
Right.
So it's not coming out of the character. It's pure cleverness. And to do one of those a show was always a challenge, or two. To do 5 of them was like degree of difficulty is like a 9. You know, it's a backward 2.5 flip with a pike, you know. And we did 5 of them. And I remember just being so proud of that we took that challenge on. So.
And that's the stuff that, you know, they've got YouTube compilations of every Norm entrance on there, just knocking them out one or the other. And those are some amazing
lines. My favorite one, well, there's 2 favorite Norm entrances. Well, my favorite one is one that Ken wrote, which was Norm comes in and says, "Hey, everybody, hey, Norm." He goes, "What are you up to, Norm?" And Norm says, "My ideal weight if I was 11 feet tall." And I just thought that was as brilliant as ever done. And it was my partner who hit that one.
David, it's such a pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure, Larry.
This has
really
been great.
A fun talk.
Thank you for the time. Can I come back to school? Is it too late?
You got your sheepskin from SC?
No, I'm still missing a semester of French, and I think I got an incomplete because I didn't turn in my Huck Finn paper.
Wow.
Yeah. So if there's a way I can make that up
in
your class.
Come on back, and we'll see if we can do some kind of equivalent.
I know I don't deserve an honorary or anything, but I'll just take it pass fail if that's cool with you.
Hey, I just went to a University of Miami reunion. They gave Stallone an honorary degree from Miami, where he went around the same time I would. So if they could just hand one to Stallone,
sure,
give one to you.
Just show my grudge match scene with him,
exactly.
And I'm in.
You're in it. In the same movie.
David, thanks, man.
My pleasure.
Get a monkey. Get a monkey!
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.